Welcome to the Reality Zone, everybody. Today is Sunday, February 24th, 2008, and we have with us today one of the world's top experts on the effects of depleted uranium used by the military in the wars in the Middle East. His name is Dr. Doug Rocky, and he's a health physicist and a career Army officer who became the Pentagon's most senior depleted uranium expert during the first Gulf War. And today he's going to describe his discovery of massive illness and death inflicted on civilians, combatants, and even his own men when they were given the assignment to try and clean up the mess that was over there. He'll tell us all about that, and it's a gripping story, and it's a very tragic story. He also will tell how he was ordered by the military to conceal this tragedy from the world, which, of course, he refused to do, and then he became persona non grata with his superiors. That, too, is an interesting and tragic story. So anyway, Doug, you're online now, and I'd like to begin this by having you tell us a little bit about your background and how you got into the military and what your assignment was there.
Okay, I'd be glad to. Well, back in the 1960s, you know, when we graduated from high school, the Vietnam War was going full bore. And as I graduated from high school in 1967, it became readily apparent that trying to obtain a college deferment was virtually impossible. And so one day before I was due to get drafted and go, you know, obviously as a ground pounder in the Army, I enlisted in the United States Air Force back in 1967. That's over 40 years ago. Wow, time flies. And as a consequence, during my first time, I became what was called a bomb nav hard hat. And it was very specialized schooling. We basically had 2 years of schooling and 2 years in Vietnam. And I had flown 38 missions on B-52s, maintained hundreds and hundreds of B-52s and their systems for bombing operations during the Vietnam War. And at the back in that time, we flew out of Utapao Air Force Base in Thailand primarily, Anderson Air Force Base on Guam, which is where the bomber went down in the last couple of days, and then also out of Kadena Air Force Base in Okinawa. So that was my first experience with the military. I got out, got recalled to active duty while I was in college again for a summer, and got out and went back to college and went on to my career. And then in 1980, I re-enlisted again, and myself and my best friend got asked, who is combat medics. So we went into the Army National Guard here in the state of Illinois, and the 2nd Battalion, 130th Infantry, as combat medics and medical team leaders. We were already civilian EMTs and emergency rescue and everything else, and they needed help, and it was you know, kind of a fun time. You knew everybody in the National Guard, and you could have fun. But we did that, and then slowly went on, became an instructor in 1983, teaching nuclear, biological, chemical warfare, teaching emergency combat medicine and other military operations at an Army Reserve Forces school, and we taught all over the Midwest. Then 1986, some 19 years after I originally enlisted, plop, plop, fizz, fizz, I started all over as a second lieutenant. My work as a senior NCO was so good that they decided to commission me and transfer me up to Fort Sheridan on the command staff, and from there, you could say the rest is history. I got commissioned as a nuclear medical sciences officer, which means a Army health physicist for those in the civilian world. And actually what it means is we are experts in nuclear, biological, chemical warfare, hazardous materials, and all of the associated stuff dealing with preventive medicine and environmental exposures. During Desert Storm, got recalled to active duty again after we'd been preparing the troops, and we knew what was coming down because, again, it was a bait and switch by the U.S. to get Iraq to invade Kuwait so we could go in there. And then we got into a real mess, needless to say. One of the things that we experienced is that we knew that prior to Gulf War I, Operation Desert Storm, that Iraq absolutely, I want to repeat, Iraq absolutely did possess chemical and biological warfare munitions. They were provided to Iraq by the United States Army. Deliberately and willfully provided to Iraq by the United States, and obviously, you know, England was also involved. And the purpose was to allow Iraq to use the chemical and biological munitions on the Iranians, which we will do again here shortly, and also to use it on the Iraqi Kurds. And so, again, you wanted to stop them, and then obviously they also have the Turkish Kurds, so they're all along the border there. and they were deliberating.
Doug, let me interrupt just for a second, if I may. You just made a very controversial statement. These weapons were provided by the United States military, I presume. Did you have firsthand knowledge of that, or did you just hear about that?
No, we have firsthand knowledge. Congressional reports absolutely verify it. If you get the Regal Commission report that was written for the United States Senate by James Toot and under Senator Regal out of Michigan, it's obviously completely verified in the actual report. The other thing which is most interesting on this is when we got over to during Desert Storm, we knew what they had and where they had it. So in December of 1990, we made a conscious decision at the command headquarters. This is in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, and this is with General Schwarzkopf, General Powell, General Chuck Horner was involved, Dick Cheney was involved, and then all of our staff was involved, that we would deliberately and willfully destroy all of Iraq's chemical and biological stockpiles in place because we knew what they had, we knew where they had it, and the intention was to destroy them in place with the hope that they would not deliberately use that then on the coalition forces as we advanced into Iraq and into Kuwait. And again, that's in Schwarzkopf's autobiography. It doesn't take a hero. All I have to do is go to page 390, and there it is, the whole discussion. It was astonishing. But we warned them at that time when we destroyed them that it was just like hitting an ice cube with a hammer. All it was going to do was spread it all over, and as a consequence, that has happened, and the casualties now are just staggering. For both all the U.S. military that participated in Desert Storm, the coalition forces, and all of the Iraqis. So that began from there. I think, you know, what got interesting, especially when we started leading into Gulf War II, which we started planning during the 1990s and actually in late fall of 1995, that's when Operation Iraqi Freedom actually started the planning, is that one of the things that they had said and what all the warnings are was anthrax, which is a biological weapon, and the anthrax spores. Iraq obtained the anthrax spores by deliberate and direct delivery from Fort Detrick, Maryland, from the United States Army. So that's how they obtained them. And again,
so you're saying, Doug, I want to make sure I get this straight. You're saying that the military knew where these stockpiles were. They went in and destroyed them in place. And then as a result of that, it spread into the civilian population and the military around.
The adverse health and environmental effects almost immediately. We started putting the reports out trying to get it done. And the senior Army officials tried to stop us almost immediately. Colonels Dunn and Colonels Wade came over from the Pentagon to stop us almost immediately. And obviously they succeeded to some extent, but they did not succeed completely because we were able to try and get a lot of the information out, get the medical care requirements out, get the environmental cleanup requirements out. And at least we attempted to do our job, although today, in hindsight, was a complete failure because of the fact that we've got hundreds of thousands that participated in Desert Storm, now very that sick and having problems, and over 70,000 dead. So that's a staggering casualties, and then the coalition forces are the same, and then the Iraqis are just, because they had to reside there and couldn't leave, it's just been a staggering toll.
Is it possible that the higher command that ordered the destruction of these stockpiles in place, that they did not know that this would be the consequence of it?
Oh, absolutely did know, and that's when you go to page 390, you can see that the discussion was there probably would be adverse health effects, and we were there, and yes, we did have that discussion, and we told them right off the bat, and that was the reason why one of the reasons Bowers Raiders was formed, our theater team reporting to D.G. Zulus, a theater medical commander, and then he reported to Schwarzkopf direct. So, yeah, we did know. And even in Schwarzkopf's autobiography on page 390, it says, well, we know there will probably be adverse health effects, but we're told when we blow them up, we'll destroy them. Well, that's pure nonsense because you have to contain them, confine them at high temperature and high pressure to destroy them. You can't just hit them with a hammer because all it does is spread it all over. So we had all of that problem and the serious adverse health effects. We had the misuse of pesticides. We had the car paint that was used, and again, the byproducts of that and the constituents as you painted all the trucks to decontaminate them was pretty severe. And then we had all the oil well fires and all the adverse health and environmental effects from the oil well fires and the constituents, the byproducts from the oil well fires, it's a toxic nightmare, a total toxic nightmare. So we immediately said that nobody should go anywhere near the oil well fires without full respiratory and skin protection. And the respiratory protection the Army had, just like for the oil well fires and all the other stuff and for DU, is woefully inadequate, just like it is to this day for anybody being deployed. But that's all you had available. So we told them, you know, Don't you go there without the respiratory skin protection. And now we've seen all the adverse health effects. So it's just a staggering thing. And then what we also had, and you have to understand, this was 1990. And I'd been in the military since 1967. I didn't know anything about depleted uranium munitions. Didn't even know they existed. And then in December 1990, I got a letter in the U.S. mail from Colonel Charles Day at the Pentagon saying, we're going to use uranium munitions. These are the problems. You better start worrying about it. And we go, oh, my. And we put the warnings in as we did the teaching, the preparation for the combat operations. And then with the completion of the ground war, they had absolutely not considered what do we do when we have all the destroyed U.S. equipment from friendly fire hit by uranium munitions. What do we do with all the casualties? What do we do with all the Iraqi, the British, the German, the French, all the other equipment destroyed with uranium munitions? Because at that time, the United States, obviously, and Canada, and Australia, and England were the only ones that possessed them, possessed uranium munitions, and primarily used by the U.S. So it turned into a total mess. And with the completion of the ground war, all of a sudden, I got called over to the command headquarters, and they said, well, Doug, you know, hey, your background's in emergency medicine, has materials, environmental stuff, you know nuclear, biological, chemical warfare, you're at the university as a physicist, y'all go clean it up. And I go, okay. Well, fortunately, when I went to war, because I was assigned to the 12th Preventive Medicine Detachment, we were the Theater Public Health Department, and each one of us officers had our own vehicle with plenty of room, I took lots of books. I'm a scientist. I'm a teacher. So I took my books with them, duffel bags full of books, so we had all the references we needed. And from that, we also obtained the U.S. Army Technical Bulletin 9-1300-278 plus other correspondence that told us rapidly of the serious adverse health and environmental effects of the use of uranium munitions. All concerns got put to us in a letter from the Defense Nuclear Agency that came on down from one of the colonels, and he said, I mean, this is not only a health threat, it's a serious health threat, and the environmental program and the cleanup is going to be a disaster. But then at the same time, Tommy Franks, you know who he is, right?
Sure.
Tommy Franks handed me a letter, told us, called the Los Alamos Memorandum, and told us to lie about our all the adverse health and environmental effects in our reports to sustain the use of uranium munitions. And that
so General Franks gave you a direct order to lie about it?
Absolutely.
Uh-huh.
Him and Brown. Yeah, just the direct thing. And, you know, we're working also at this time for Schwarzkopf, and then we moved out to Gus Pagonis. So all these guys are there. And that memorandum still exists. It's called the Los Alamos Memorandum. It was issued on March 1st of 1991 by Colonel Michael Zeem, United States Marines Corps colonel, scientist at Los Alamos. And it was very clear. You know, they had very lot of concerns about the adverse health and environmental effects, but they're going to sustain them, so therefore we maintain at proponency, and therefore we lie on our reports whenever. We had problems because we were all getting sick within 24 to 48 hours. We saw everybody else was. We had a whole lot of Abrams tanks and Bradley fighting vehicles that were shot up with depleted uranium-friendly fire. See, one thing most people don't understand is the majority of the U.S. casualties during direct combat engagements during Operation Desert Storm were friendly fire, not Iraqi military shooting U.S. troops, U.S. troops shooting U.S. troops, primarily with uranium munitions. So we had to clean that all up and order medical care for everybody, which to this day has never been done. I mean, the medical care that we ordered and we required, and I'm the one that issued the original directive, and then that was followed by the theater medical commander under General Zulus, who was the theater medical commander, to do it, and it's never been done to this day. It's totally astonishing. It's a tragedy. The United States made a conscious choice, along with Canada, Australia, and England, to use radioactive materials that are solid radioactive waste, the main byproduct of the enrichment process at Paducah, Kentucky, Oak Ridge, Tennessee, Portsmouth, Ohio, and then obviously, you know, the British facilities. It's that simple. How do we get rid of our radioactive waste?
What was the reasoning for choosing depleted uranium munitions? Why did they do that?
Well, depleted uranium munitions are actually, there's nothing really depleted about them, so to speak. That's just a term, but it's actually a scientific term. What you have is for every 100 pounds of pure radioactive materials, that's the isotopes of uranium-238, uranium-234, and uranium-235. This is the pure stuff that goes into the reactor vessels at Oak Ridge, Paducah, and Portsmouth. What you have originally is you have 99.2 pounds is the isotope made up of uranium isotope 238. And then you have 0.8 pounds as the fissionable isotopes. That's a combination primarily 235 and 234. What we want to do is extract the fissionable isotopes. So for every 100 pounds that goes into the process, you can extract 0.6 pounds of the isotopes 235 and 236. Those are fissionable isotopes. They are then you know, go through the whole process to make nuclear bombs in reactor fuel. So we got out of the beginning stuff, we have over 99% is just pure waste. Well, that pure waste is uranium hexafluoride. And it's processed, it's a gas, and there's thousands and thousands of tanks of this stuff all over down there. And it's very dangerous. And it's in process, and that becomes depleted uranium. So the depleted uranium round is actually a solid rod or a solid bullet or a solid shell of uranium. And it has uranium-238, uranium-234, and 235. It has plutonium, neptunium, americium, all in the contaminants because the reactor vessels get cross-contaminated with those other isotopes. So you got originally uranium-238, primarily isotope, 234, 235, uranium-236, plutonium, neptunium, and americium. This is not a good cocktail to be exposed to. And again, we have all of the radiation associated with it. We have the alpha particles, we have the beta particles, we have the gamma rays, we have an X-rays. You know, and again, in the, all of those different things, we have all of the byproducts, you know, as they start to decay. So again, it's a toxic cocktail, both radiologically and chemically. It's sort of like eating lead paint dust. You know, when you mix coffee in the morning, instead of just putting sugar in, put lead in or put uranium in, and that's what's happening to you.
So why would the military want to make munitions out of this stuff?
It's incredibly effective. Uranium is soft and malleable, can be shaped easily. It's pyrophoric, which makes it means it ignites in the air, okay? I mean, ignites in the air. Just the friction of the air is flying through the air, it becomes burning. And then when it breaks up, all the other particles will break up. You have a showering firestorm of burning and unburning uranium fragments, then cause catastrophic, I mean catastrophic, secondary ignitions and burning and catastrophic explosions. Because, you know, what you have is high, fast-moving particles of different sizes and shapes and all on fire. And when you're a military vehicle, you got fuel, okay, you got explosives. In a house, an apartment building, you've got all of the combustible materials. It's the best thing next to sliced bread. It's absolutely incredible, the effectiveness of it. And that's what I saw when I cleaned up the U.S. friendly fire vehicles. I had basically 15 Abrams tanks and 15 Bradley fighting vehicles that we brought back. But we couldn't bring everything back, so we buried a lot of Bradleys that were completely destroyed in the desert in northern Saudi Arabia. And we returned 15 Abrams tanks and 9 Bradley fighting vehicles to Barnwell, South Carolina. And they went in through the port of Charleston and ended up contaminating all the way along on the rail lines. And then it took 3 years just to properly clean up and try to dispose of some of these at Barnwell in the most sophisticated facility of its kind in the world, the only facility of its kind in the world. And so that's what we do know happened. As a consequence, we contacted the GAO, you know, in Congress, and everybody was yelling and screaming. We started putting our reports together, put our reports together for the military, and they did everything they could to kill it. Well, slowly it became alive again. And then in, I guess it was probably late January of 1992, I was called to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base and give the first conference for a medical conference for the Secretariat, okay, out of the Department of Defense and the senior medical people and say, we got a serious problem. We got the oil well fires. We got uranium. We've got to do something about this. Well, that put a lot of warnings up. And as a consequence of that and other reports I wrote, that we wrote, not just myself, a whole group of us, and other concerns from sick veterans that are already sick, we started the United States Army Environmental Policy Institute study on depleted uranium in December of 1992. In 1993, January 93, the GAO came out with a report saying the military blew it completely. And they stated, you know, very clearly they needed prime medical care. Well, as we were putting that report together and I was called in to do it very specifically for the Army, they was put on loan from the University of Illinois over to the CIRL, the main Army lab, to do environmental. And then while I was already there, they started the AAPI project, so I was called in on that immediately. Because they said, well, that's the expert. It's very simple. Have them come do it. From that, initial report on our recommendations, and we did what's called a staff study. Staff study in the military is where you list all what's happening, how it's all going together, what needs to be done, you know, how to solve the problem. And as a consequence, the U.S. Army depleted uranium project, in which became a Department of Defense project, which became a NATO project, was enacted. And here I am. We're up to August of 1994. I initially enlisted in October of 1967. So this is many, many years. You have to understand, 20 years is a full career and you're done and gone. Okay, for almost everybody. 25 for senior officers, maybe 30 at the outside. And I'm back as the director of the U.S. Army Depleted Uranium Project to develop all the education and training materials, to develop all of the procedures for environmental cleanup and everything, which is today Army Regulation 700-48 that is mandated by signature of General Eric Shinseki, who has since retired. And we had all the training, so it ended up with 40 hours of training, three different tiers, one general for everybody in the military and all the civilians associated with the military, the second tier, which would be first tier and second tier, specifically for all the crews and the people using uranium munitions. They'd had to use them and, you know, and then take care of the equipment after it's been fired, you know, clean it up, repair it, or whatever. And then the final third tier, or the third tier, which included all three tiers, was for the experts, you know, the chemical corps, nuclear biological engineers, and very specifically for the medical people. So we had all those warnings. And all along, we were having problems doing getting sick and everything else. So as part of this work, I was dispatched or deployed, as we call it in the military, to Mercury, Nevada, the Nevada test site, for two series of tests over 2 years. And what we did was extensive tests on the use of uranium munitions, the effectiveness of uranium munitions, how do you clean it up, how do you detect it, what happens when it goes off. And it scared the bejesus out of us. But from that testing is what I verified and I validated to write the Army Regulation 700-48. We ended up modifying the U.S. Army Technical Bulletin 9-1300-278, and we ended up writing the DA U.S. Army Pamphlet 700-48, which is the nuts and bolts procedures, the hands-on, how do you do it type things. We also put the common task training together for these individuals. Now, you guys have these so you can post them onto your website, you know, so everybody can read them for themselves. And it's very important they do. And then, again, trying to get the medical all done. What happened personally with myself, we're already sick and haven't gone down. Got the respiratory, they found the calcified granulomas, got the rashes, everything else is coming down. The neurological problems, all this stuff is already affecting me. But when we did the Nevada test, using all the protective equipment the U.S. Department of Energy had available, plus the equipment that the U.S. military had available, we still got exposed again. And in November of 1994, the U.S. Department of Energy finally ran a bioassay on me. Now, the Army has never done it to this day. They have totally disregarded their orders for myself and my staff and my team members and never done it. They simply refuse to do it. Because if they do it, they would have done it right away. They would find the correlation between exposures and all of the documented adverse health effects and then also the environmental effects. Well, they did it, and they knew within a few months by late February, that I was zapped and blowing hotter than blue blazes 5,000 times permissible level. And they never told me for 2.5 years.
So you're saying you were radioactive?
Very, extraordinarily. I was, you know what I mean, pissing fire uranium 5,000 times permissible level. And I was having kidney problems, all over bleeding, you know, just urinating, everything else, all the rashes, respiratory, severe lung problems. And they never told me. They never told me for 2.5 years. So I'd long gone home. I was out of the project, and I got back home, and I'm going down, and we finally got the information. So this is after I served as a director of the Depleted Uranium Project and put everything together. And despite all of our efforts to this day, we have not been able to get the full training implemented. We have not been able to get all the medical care implemented that's all required. We cannot get the Department of Defense, anybody within the Department of Defense or the VA, to provide the prompt and effective medical care that is required by their own directives. But the other thing, what we can't do is I can't get them to stop using uranium munitions because they're extraordinarily effective. And they don't care what target they use. They have to understand uranium munitions are more effective against a house, an apartment building, and a water treatment facility, and a hospital sewage sanitation than against any tank. And they're used all against all targets. Totally 100% dossiers, but on-site photographs and direct direct discussions with those using them. What we have in uranium munitions is a whole host. We have the kinetic energy penetrators. The big ones, you got a single round over 10 pounds fired by each Abrams tank. You know, in all the tanks, they're about 10 pounds each, every single round, solid round of uranium and all the contaminants. Then the A-10 Warthog aircraft fires a solid round, and each solid round is 3/4 pound of uranium, and it fires it at 4,000 rounds per minute. That's a ton and a half of uranium on target per minute. Then you have the 30 millimeter. That's by that. Then you have the 25 millimeter fired by the Bradley fighting vehicle and the Marine Corps lab and all of those, you know, small armored car type things. Incredibly, and each one of those are about a half a pound of solid uranium. Each and every round. Then we have the machine gun bullets on down. In addition to that, we have the cluster bombs. Now, the cluster bombs were used extraordinarily effectively during Desert Storm. They were used in the Balkans and, you know, all over that, in the Balkans and that marketplace that happened in Kosovo. The United Nations ordered the Department of Defense to clean it up. Dr. Pekka Visto from the UN did, and they just totally refused to do it. And then they go on to say it's, you know, safe and don't have to worry about it. And then they were used extraordinarily effectively in Lebanon here a couple summers ago, you know, with the stuff the United States gave to Israel. So Israel also has used it extraordinarily effectively. In fact, Israel was the first military force to use uranium munitions against the Egyptians in the Sinai in 1973. So we've had a disaster. So, you know, when I came on, you had, I think it was a mother that was talking about one of their child, not a child, you know, a young adult in the military that's being deployed, but they're told that the uranium munitions have absolutely no adverse health effects on them. I can't even begin to describe how much of a lie that is.
So what you're saying, Doug, is that the military, at least, is determined to press for the military advantage with total disregard for the side effects or the blowback or the health hazards to their own men or anything else, just to put the military objective up front of everything.
That's absolutely correct. I mean, we did that, you know, beginning with the original nuclear bombs, you know, and the nuclear weapons. And then during the Vietnam War, they did it with Agent Orange, which is still having a horrible effects on all of us Vietnam veterans. Okay. Then we had it with all the immunizations. We had the same thing with the Project Shad. I mean, Project Shad, I mean, you can go to the Internet and type it in and get it all up, just Project Shad, S-H-A-D. And this is deliberate by the military, the use of chemical and biological and radiological materials against U.S. civilians and U.S. military throughout CONUS and overseas and in our oceans. I mean, deliberate exposures to find out what would happen. And that continues to this day. You had Project Shad, and then we had all the immunizations, had the ChemBio stuff all over the place that we've used, not only throughout, you know, in war zones, but throughout the United States. In fact, outside of Washington, D.C., they're still trying to clean up all of the gross contamination from the chemical and biological munitions that are out there and were disposed of and used out there. Chesapeake Bay, because the Aberdeen Proving Ground, Maryland, I wouldn't even put my pinky into that bay, much less eat any food or get any water out of it. It's that contaminated, and that's thoroughly documented. So we go through, and then obviously Agent Orange throughout Vietnam, and then we go on to uranium munitions and everything else. And then we go to the chem bio that we've given to all of these nations, and then we decide to destroy it. We don't really destroy it. All we do is spread it. And then the other thing we've done is completely destroying all these nations' infrastructures and releasing all the toxic industrial chemical compounds. You know, that includes heavy metals, carcinogens, everything else, solvents. And then we have all of, obviously, the biological materials and the radiological materials that are used throughout industry, agriculture, medicine, and education that are now released on everything. So what we have is a complete toxic wasteland, a toxic nightmare that we deliberately caused through our combat actions with a complete total disregard for the adverse health and environmental effects. And then anybody that speaks up, well, you know, how fast can you become persona non grata?
Do you think from your experience that there is an awareness of this above the military at the civilian political center in Washington?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I personally briefed everybody, myself and Major Denise Nichols, another great nurse, and Vietnam, the Desert Storm hero, who's also very sick from exposure. The two of us were asked to, and we prepared the full report on uranium munitions and the adverse health and environmental effects for the United States House of Representatives, for the House Oversight Commission, by directive of Christopher Shays and Bernard Sanders, and we presented it both oral and written testimony. I mean, hours and hours and hours of written oral testimony, and then, you know, dozens and dozens, I don't know, probably 100-some-odd pages. So, yeah, they're totally aware. I mean, President Bush is totally aware. President Bill William Clinton was totally aware. I mean, what's her name, Senator Clinton, she's totally aware, 100% aware, doesn't care. McCain, totally aware, doesn't care. And Barack Obama, I briefed and sent all kinds of information to his staff, and I have no indications whatsoever. So, I mean, it's the whole thing, but again, we have to sustain the military operations, sustain the use of the weapons, you know, with all the lies of everything that have been told on and on again about what our military does and why they do it.
It's ironic because we're supposedly doing this sort of thing to give the military some kind of an advantage, but at the same time wiping out the military itself.
Correct. And, I mean, you've got, you know, the casualties are staggering. I mean, when we look at the actual casualty numbers, okay, you can obtain the actual casualty numbers, and again, they're supposed to be published quarterly, but again, you know, today, what can I say? They're not going to publish information that they can get away from it. So if we go back to May of 2007, and we go to the actual U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs Gulf War Veterans Information System. Now, this report in May of 2007 is the last one was published. They've not published them since, even though they're supposed to come out quarterly. Specifically identifies a number of individuals that participated in Operation Desert Storm that have now submitted for medical care and what's been happening to them. So for Desert Storm alone, this is known as Gulf War I, 696,842 participated. As of May of 2002, only 620,266 are still alive. So that's 76,000 have died. I had less than 1,000 die, actually less than 500 die, during the actual Desert Storm. So we have 76,000 die since then. As of May of 2007, 280,623 had applied for permanent lifetime medical care and disability with the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs. And they have completely denied, at that time, denied medical care to 30,679, and the claims that were pending at that time was 38,398. Well, this is almost a year ago since the last report was filed. Now, what we do know also from this report, that as of May of 2007, everybody that's gone into the Persian Gulf and all this nonsense, was 1,129,340. As of May of 2007, out of everybody that's been deployed in there for this nonsense, only 963,083 still remain alive. It's 170,000 dead. And out of the total number that remain alive, 407,911 had applied for permanent lifetime medical care with the VA. So these are the individuals that have gone to the VA for medical care. The other thing with the report that I got, the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs publishes what we call the Disease and Non-Battle Injury Report. Okay? Well, the last one that we've got published was published in late October. It came out in November of last year. And what they identified is that of November, you know, October, you know, end of October of 2007, 263,909 individuals that came through there have gone to the VA for medical care. Now, what we were able to do is force Dr. Kilpatrick, the Department of Defense and VA, provide medical care to individuals once they come back from overseas and military deployment without applying for, you know, the VA disability. Most time, the only way you can get medical care if you're in the military and get wounded, injured, sick, or anything, you've got to apply to the VA for a permanent disability. We were able to force a law through where they would give 2 years of medical care to everybody. So as of the end of October of 2007, out of everybody that had gone over there, and this is just the DNBI stuff. This is not those that have applied for, you know, with what's happening showing up with the VA. We had 28,665 with infectious and parasitic diseases. We had 2,193 with confirmed cancers. Now, 20 of those were in one unit alone that we know of because the unit commander, and they came down with cancer. His father was one of the original colonels and the doctors on our original team during Desert Storm. We had 9,129 benign neoplasms, 50,968 nutritional, endocrine, metabolic problems, 5,086 with serious blood problems, On the mental disorders, PTSD, which we need to cover, that was 100,580. Neurological problems, okay, this is peripheral and central neuropathies, 83,273. Circulatory, this is, you know, the heart and everything else, in the arteries, veins, arterioles, bronchioles, everything, 39,633. Respiratory at this time was 49,464. Digestive system was 81,427. Now, what we're seeing in the digestive system, my commander is yelling and screaming. He was yelling and screaming as they were dying at Womack Army Medical Center at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. We've seen it here at Danville at the Medical Center. We've seen it in India in the Medical Center. The esophagus and all the gastrointestinal system, the stomach and everything else, it just turns to mush. It's like jello. It just disintegrates to nothing. And then the gentral and urinary system, 25,561. The rashes, 38,791. I have to understand, I'm literally open and bleeding as we speak from my rash that I got within 24 hours in March of 1991. Did you understand me?
I certainly did.
Okay, muscular skeletal system, we're at 117,424. And what the muscular skeletal system connective tissue shows up and they diagnose, and I got a disability for, is diagnosed as fibromyalgia. So what we actually have happening is the O2 perfusion, because you got to remember you're taking oxygen in through the lungs. Now the alveoli sacs are destroyed, so we get inadequate O2 in through the lungs into the blood. So we have inadequate O2 perfusion through. Then what we have is, because of the same thing, we have inadequate nutrition. Now because of the cellular damage, we have inadequate absorption of the O2 in the nutrition, but we have inadequate redistribution or removal of the metabolic byproducts of all of this, okay? So the poisons build up. And obviously then we have high levels of CO2. So, you know, CO2 removal is bad. PO2 is quite bad. And so what we end up with is similar like fibromyalgia. The pain's excruciating. Pain pills don't cut it. You know, you can't live on pain pills. What I do is I only attempt to take it in the evening, you know, before I go to bed, because otherwise I can't function. And then ill-defined conditions, we were at 93,093, and poisonings, we were at 48,736. Now, this, again, is 5 months ago, or 4 months ago. And when we look at the epidemiology, I can go back a few months and look at the last report. The numbers are staggering as they go up, and we look at the actual epidemiology. Now, on the mental disorders, PTSD, we got two different parts actually happening here, or three different parts. We have the neurophysiology as a consequence of all of the toxic exposures, which affects the total function of the peripheral and the central nervous system, okay? And as a consequence, everything turns horrible. Then you have get scared, totally scared, just the good old combat stress. And then the third part is the fact that the realization of everything you've been doing on is based on lies. In other words, Iraq did not pose any threat to us ever, never has. Afghanistan never has posed any threat. The Balkans never posed any threat. Somalia has never posed any threat. So all of our invasions are strictly set up, total lies, to control the oil and the resource and the terrain. And then what you see today is any Iraq or anybody that opposes us, they're the residents of these areas, and we invaded these areas, we call them insurgents, as if we can somehow label them, and by labeling the residents of these areas, they're bad, because they oppose our invasion and our occupation and destruction of their lifestyles.
It's a horrible story. What treatment is available?
Okay, well, let's look at the health effects that we know and we can document. Okay, first off, we have the rash. And there's virtually nothing you can do. You can use ketoconazole cream, and again, you have to talk to a medical doctor, a physician. Okay, but they give me ketoconazole cream to control the rash. And all you're doing is treating the symptoms. The respiratory problems, there's nothing that can be done for that. You just have to maintain operation, whatever you're doing, your diet, and the whole shebang. The other thing we have, again, with your standard Tylenol, aspirin, and all this stuff, although it doesn't really dent, so they give you more powerful stuff to control that. What we have is decalcification of the bone and the teeth. So that's osteopenia, osteoporosis, decalcification of the teeth. Fosamax, again, is what they prescribe for me. And, you know, again, you have to talk to a physician, very, very, very good physician who cares and looks and understands everything. The other thing, too, is what I had happen, and we had deterioration of the eye. So we had radiation cataracts. Well, they just go in and they rebuild your eye. I've got the left done. Hopefully I'll get the right done someday. The hearing, I've got a hearing aid now. Again, so what's happened, that's the neurological problems plus the toxic exposures plus all of the explosions. So we have a whole complex mixture of everything. And so you've got everything coming down. So, and then the other thing, what we do know, I want to make this very loud and clear, very, very loud and clear. What we do know, and this is common preventive medicine and everything else, and all the doctors I've worked with and different teams we've worked with, you can no longer drink. Alcohol has got to be completely removed from your diet. You can no longer drink. You can no longer smoke cigarettes. I mean, you just can't do it. And then the other thing, too, is on nutrition. You have to optimize nutrition, so obviously omit caffeine, because caffeine's a toxic poison also. So, I mean, definite diet changes. Then you have to go to a high-protein diet, and you have to have a totally balanced diet across all food groups. Then you have to get rest. You have to watch out for temperature. A problem I have with the winter here in Illinois, it's cold. We've been really cold. Well, peripheral neuropathy, I don't know when my feet and hands are getting cold. And when I go to get a bath, if I draw a bath, I can't sense the temperature of the bath with my feet or my hands. We have a real thing, and you have to get to an expert in medicine, a physician, specialist in occupational environmental medicine. Some of the VA programs are supposed to be set up, but they just turn you away. I was turned away back on January 30th by my own primary care. I said, we have to deal with the neurophysiology, all of these exposures. And they said, we don't have any expertise, you're on your own. Well, thank you very much.
Well, Doug, are you aware of any chelating materials or things that would can actually pull this stuff out of you?
There's stuff in the chelation, but you remember what we have at the primary, the damage, the stuff isn't so much there that it keeps radiating as we have all the extensive damage that's been done. Mm-hmm. Yeah, if originally when we had the exposures, the original reason we wanted the testing and this mandating testing was the 24 hours of exposure. That's what the Department of Defense and the VA absolute requirement is, 24 hours of exposure. Then you can hopefully do some chelation. But the chelation only removes the mobile fraction, the very, very small fraction that's mobile in the urine that can be solubilized, you know, soluble. And that's a very, very small fraction of the whole thing. So you can't. I mean, there's some other, hemopathic, things here. But, man, you have to be, no matter what, you have to be under constant care of an expert in environmental and occupational medicine. I mean, you can't try doing any of this stuff because you don't know what the effects are. I can't stress enough. You have to be under a physician's direct control and guidance, one that knows, cares, bothers to do the research, look what's happening now, and think about what's happening. Because we have complex exposures affecting all the body systems.
A little while ago, you mentioned a problem with the immunizations given to the military. Would you like to address that one?
Yeah. We had a lot of experimental immunizations. And the other thing, and I have to understand, I was a participant of this personally. We gave, 6, 8, 10, 12 immunizations simultaneously to individuals. You can't do that. The body's not made to sustain itself because an immunization has to create antibodies. So if you give one drug or immunization to immunize against one disease, you're going to have those effects in the body. And most everybody, everybody knows, some people get sick from measles shots, mumps shots, you get rubella, you get tetanus, typhoid, you get sick from those. Well, you can't combine all these things and give them together, everybody. Because, I've been giving them when you get deployed, but I had a whole bunch at once, and I was so sick for the next, week that it was incredible. And we affects the immune system. Now, the other thing we know is the anthrax vaccine's a nightmare. There's a squalene and all the other stuff, and we've had incredible numbers of people that came down sick with the anthrax vaccine. And, in fact, during Desert Storm, we knew that Iraq had weaponized anthrax and would use it during Desert Storm because it was deliberately and willfully shipped by the United States Army from Fort Detrick, Maryland, to Iraq. We got the shipping documents in the Regal Commission. We knew that we had to administer the anthrax vaccine. Now, that was only good for, cutaneous anthrax, not for respiratory anthrax. But what we were ordered to do is give the anthrax, and we had no choice. We knew they had it. And then we were ordered not to report it, not to record any of the adverse health effects, no VIRS forms, nothing, who got what, how much they got, when they got it, or what the adverse health effects were. Deliberate directive. It's, how do you put this? Anybody that goes in the military today, you realize you're going to be a guinea pig. You're going to be exposed to all this stuff. You will not obtain and receive the medical care. You're not going to have the proper equipment to protect your respiratory skin. You're not going to be given the proper training. And they don't care. And they all know, all the way up to the president, through multiple presidents. personally can verify, you know, three presidents that know and every candidate now going knows.
Well, that rather relates to a question that came in just a moment ago from Joe Marie Johnson. This is somewhat repetitious of what you covered, but I think it's so important, Doug, to cover it again. Here's her question. She says, I know that the USS Cleveland, an amphibian ship, has depleted uranium bombs. The military personnel are being told that they won't hurt them, but it does kill them. Why does the military have to use them? We have plenty of other types of bombs. I heard of a lot of Iraqi babies are being born deformed. Is that true? If it is true, then I don't understand the cruelty. Why would the U.S. want to have the next generation deformed? Please shed some light on this for me.
First off, not only the Iraqi, but the U.S. military also. And probably out of the Gulf War II, Operation Iraqi Freedom, the members of the 442nd New York Military Police Unit that came back, conceived children with all kinds of birth defects. You have to understand, these were the heroes of 442nd, were the police and fire that went in to the World Trade Center that survived and then got activated and deployed. Okay, but that whole 911 thing could go on and on. That's a whole black operations again, too. But, yeah, again, it comes down to it. They don't care. Now, the Navy deliberately uses uranium munitions not only in the aircraft, but they have it on the Phalanx. Okay? And so they're shooting it all over the harbors, the bays, and everything else, and the torpedoes, the whole shebang. I mean, Congressman James McDermott of Seattle, Washington, absolutely got it confirmed from the Navy, and I was in his office when we got the letter, that the Coast Guard cutters and Navy was shooting it in Puget Sound and then off the coast. No two ways about it. And we know it's confirmed in Chesapeake Bay and off the coast of all, so they go out there going to do it. They don't care. Some years ago, again, this goes back to preparation for going into Kosovo in the Balkans, and you have to understand, first we went in 94, 95, then we back in 99. Well, in preparation for the 98, 99 operations, uranium munitions were extensively used with horrible results in Vieques, Puerto Rico. And then they totally disregarded it. After they were used, I tried to team, according to the Army regulations and medical orders, and the Pentagon absolutely refused to do so. They told me, we will not do it, Doug. And so that's been a nightmare.
What about the stories we hear of military using DU in Hawaii?
Absolutely confirmed. In fact, right now we're working with the legislators. Their uranium munitions absolutely used in Hawaii. In fact, they use the Davy Crockett's, which have DU components, back in the 50s, and Davy Crockett's are nuclear weapons. These are the handheld small nuclear weapons. So absolutely confirmed. So we have out there at the barracks, Schofield Barracks, that area is contaminated. We got the training grounds contaminated. They have used it and will continue to use it, and right now we're trying to get the uranium cleaned up in Hawaii without any success. And, in fact, it's in the legislature there, and I got another request today from the people working on this, getting information to them, trying to ensure that they can force the military to comply. The military officials have totally disregarded their actions, and now they just totally, totally disregard the adverse health and environmental effects, refuse to clean it up, even though their own Army Regulation 700-48, the U.S. Army Technical Pamphlet 9-1300-278, and the Army Procedures DAPAM 700-48 require it. They don't care. They don't care. And no leader. Despite all the talks we can't get the leaders to do it. We file, Inspector General reports. We file complaints and reports with the command, ask them to do it, and they just don't even return a phone call.
Do you think that the generals at the highest command levels, are they living in some kind of an air-conditioned environment where they don't think they're going to be affected by this?
Yeah, they think you're immune. And most do. Same thing, the soldiers going out, they got the John Wayne and Rambo mentality. They're immune to everything and that they're doing good. We have to come down to, I want to come down to the real fundamental thing. We continue to go to war, invade, and attack and everything. We have not had any enemy with viable threat against the United States to overthrow our government, to suspend our Constitution and can't take again a Bill of Rights since the War of 1812. And even then, when the British totally sacked and burned Washington, the government didn't fall. So we have not had any. They don't exist. It's all nonsense. And this bothers me because I had to come to the realization, when they keep saying that you served in the military, you're out there to defend our Constitution, protect our rights and our freedoms. No. We're out there advancing the specific economic interests, the greed, the corruption, and control, seizing territories, invading, taking over territories, killing and destroying, contaminating the environment with a complete, total disregard. And, man, that's hard to say.
From a military career officer like you, I would imagine.
Yeah, it's a realization, but do a real critical analysis and think about it. Really think about it. don't just take the, you know, the mom apple pie and Chevrolet stuff and all those statements that are made. Truly think about it. We're getting ready to go into Nigeria next, obviously because of the oil, so they got the Africa Command.
Jay Myers writes in and asks, what can we citizens do? That's a good thing to end this with, I think.
It's very simple. Contact your congressman, your senator, demand action. If you've got anybody in the military, let them know what's happening. Prevent any. Make sure that everybody you know gets the medical care they need. Contact the President of the United States. Contact every elected official. Because you have to understand, this is not a national problem. It's a hometown problem. Because when they come back sick, injured, and ill, and they have all kinds of problems, and the children are affected, and the schools are affected, it's a hometown problem. As Denise Nichols and some of the other chaplains said, we got to mobilize God's army to do what's right, to create peace, to teach people to live together in harmony and peace, and to share and not to steal and covet and everything else. It's a time for peace to reign on earth. And it's a time for us to stand up and be counted and demand accountability. We have to remember, the president, the senators, the generals, we don't work for them. They work for us.
Well, Doug, that was a very powerful closing thought, and I thank you for that. Alan McConnell is hopefully still online. Alan is the guy that puts these conference calls together, so he's entitled, manyfold entitled, to have a crack at this. Alan, do you have any questions or comments you'd like to make?
Yeah, I have a couple of questions. Before I was going to ask about aspartame.
Well, aspartame and all of the artificial sweeteners, what we do know happened during Desert Storm, is these artificial sweeteners and aspartame undergo a chemical reaction when they get brought up to high temperatures, as we saw over there. You know, we got high temperatures, very low temperatures. And what happens is we see the aspartame absolutely does change chemically into methanol, wood alcohol. And from that, it does change next into formaldehyde. So what you end up is toxic formaldehyde poisoning. So, again, depends on how much you have and everything else. It absolutely did occur, and that's that totally documented. And, in fact, the nurses on our staff and our team that were involved in this stuff that didn't catch it right away, they definitely went down with it. And, again, so we have a total thing. It was well known. Again, it was identified by the veterinary corps during Desert Storm and afterwards, and a problem that was identified and it's just forgot about. You know, again, a lot of money to be made on here. Now, as long as you don't have these extreme temperature changes, it's probably not going to go bad or any short period of time. But what we did experience in combat with transportation, shipment, storage, and distribution, yeah, we had a problem, and we have continued to have a problem.
So when we're talking about aspartame, we're really talking about diet soda drinks, right?
That's correct.
Yeah, so they ship billions of gallons of Diet Pepsi or Diet Coke, and then they come down with formaldehyde poisoning. Is that it?
That's basically what happens through the metabolic pathways, yes. You know, and our nurses and medical staff, the doctors that actually worked on this, I'm relating exactly what they told me and what I do know from reading the reports and, you know, and everything else. You can't take this stuff. Technology has gone crazy. We don't have better living through chemistry. You can't expose the body to all this stuff. There is no safe levels of inorganic, organic compounds. There is no safe level of biologicals. There is no safe level of radiologicals. The number of toxins in the human body today is staggering. The number of toxins in a newborn is staggering. We have to stop the nonsense. Desert Storm, Gulf War, all this stuff is a warning. What we had is an extremely healthy cohort group that got zapped by all this stuff, and now we see the adverse health effects. Well, we're seeing it long term in the general population all around the world.
Well, Doug, your story has been quite amazing to me, and I thought I knew a lot about this, but the details that you've provided just remind me once again of how important our work is, and I thank you for taking the time to share this with our subscribers and our members.
Well, gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Doug Rocky, for coming on, and thanks, everybody, for listening in, coming to the Reality Zone, and we'll see you next month on our conference call. Goodbye.